Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hi, everyone. Thanks again for joining us as you have these many years at The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. Claire and I were just talking about the fact that the last time I interviewed her was in 2013 for Battleborn. And our guest today is Claire Vanette Watkins, author of I Love You, But I've Chosen Darkness, published by Riverhead almost exactly 2 weeks ago. So, and as I said, after Battleborn, her novel Gold Fame Citrus was published in 2015. So I Love You, But I've Chosen Darkness is a novel, but a novel with Claire as the star. So whether it's autobiographical is really not a question that the reader need interest themselves with, but, you know, the reviewers do. So we're going to talk about her dad and her mom and her friends and her boyfriends and husband and child, but it's up to us and maybe learning through this conversation where we are in this land, this universe of us. Plus, we get to deal with nipple pads, teeth and vaginas, floods in Las Vegas and elsewhere, open marriages, abandonment of children, Joyce Carol Oates' office, and microgenerations. And initially, and most importantly, the Edinburgh postnatal depression scale. And as to Claire being the gnomon in the book that we revolve around, which is like a terrible metaphor, we admit things to ourselves, but not to our person, which is a credo I've followed for good or for bad most of my conscious life. Actually, I think all of my conscious life. So hi, Claire, how are you?
I'm okay. That was a very intense introduction. That was fun though.
Well, there's so many, I mean, that's the thing about it. And the reason why I like your writing so much is there's so many things you can just kind of like pull out. I mean, cause it starts, usually I forget to ask the author what their book is about, like Terry Grosswood right away. No, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to ask what it's about.
You have a feud going with Terry?
What?
You have beef with Terry? Are you guys feuding?
People feud with her? No, I don't have a beef. It's just that like, I ask questions that are really weird and inane and offensive where she tries to be like pleasant.
Yeah, she would be like right now in her show would be the moment when you're like, when you were growing up, were vaginas with teeth a big part of your childhood or whatever, which I love. I love that move.
Well, let's go to vaginas. So vaginas with teeth, it's a myth. It's a myth and a legend, and there's all kinds of stuff about it. But there also is a medical condition, which is rare, and cystoid. But if we're going for the autobiographical angle, did you ever experience such a thing?
You know that that's not even the question to ask. I know you're just being an imp now.
You wrote it.
I know, but what's interesting about it to me is that these are just different names for the same thing, as I think Death Cab for Cutie said. You know, this is a vaginal dermoid cyst is today's vagina dentata, maybe. But the vagina dentata myth is like with us all around. It's like the idea that vaginas are powerful and scary and unknown. And there were like contraptions to combat this fear, this primitive fear of like, what happens to my penis when it disappears? And then how come she just walks back from the desert with a little infant, right? Like what's going on? This like deep primitive, like pre-linguistic fear is like recycled in all these myths about this, like women that are so powerful that they have to be contained in some way, like law or property. You know, property law.
Yeah, having practiced law for 40 years, I pretty much got that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, but anyway, there's a moment in the book and in that scene in which it's clear that what you're trying to convey is that your child, the baby, that there is a remnant of that child that will stay with you inside of you and pose a threat to someone or not. And that was really interesting too, because it was just kind of an aside, but then you definitely catch it. You know, it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of. So hold up the book. You have one there, a copy?
I can get one. I can procure one. All right, got it.
Okay, and I don't usually do this, but one of the reviews go, oh, it's so coy the way that she sticks a novel in there in cursive. So, like, do you have some kind of beef with that? Did you do it on purpose? Why did you do it? Blah, blah, blah.
Oh, yeah. When I designed my own jacket, that was a decision. Ooh. No, of course, I didn't design it. I don't think it's coy. I mean, I don't think it's even the most interesting question to ask. Like, another person put it, I think Hillary Kelly in the LA Times said something like, the book is kind of against the idea that something has to be either fact or fiction, you know? So it's just this novel that's in the form of a truth, but all novels are. It's just it just uses autobiography as a formal container or something.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, you could compare it to, on the nasty side, A Million Little Pieces by Fry, and say, you know, this is all lies. And I'm thinking, well, you know, you're entitled to lie. Why not? You're writing. You can lie whatever you want. And then I interviewed Charles Yu a couple of times about how to live safely in a science fictional universe in Chinatown and all that. And since his protagonist is always Charles Yu, I said, you are always going to be in it. You is always going to be in it. And I said, you're going to be stuck with it for the rest of your life. And because, oh, wait a minute. So the title, so you know, I mean, did you get it from that post-punk revival band group?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, the boyfriend in the novel loves that band and he has that tattooed on him. So yeah, indirectly, yeah.
And so I couldn't guess what song of theirs, unless I missed that too.
I wouldn't know.
Okay. Yeah, there's one song they have called According to Plan that says, in a perfect world, or perfect place is with, my perfect place is with you, but the truth is the world is without love. And kind of struck me, but in any event. So, because I own a bookstore, cover is really important, because as I say in every interview, as many times as you can hear someone say, you don't judge a book by its cover, everyone who comes in and sees your book on the front table is going to judge it in part, if they don't know about it, by the cover, which is a cool cover too. And then because of the bookstore, I always ask about the epigraph.
Mm-hmm.
And in most cases, and actually I was listening in Battleborn where you said you thought about the epigraph a long time. In this case, it's basically just your mother saying a sentence, two sentences. It's like, just like you'd be sitting at the kitchen table and she goes, you know, I wish that, so how did that come to be?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if it's much of a sitting at a kitchen table sentence. I'll read it. And then we'll let the people decide. Okay, it says, I often wondered where I'd have been if I was in a city and a stranger to my neighbors, as I so often had been in Las Vegas. So like, it's actually, to me, a very stylish, bizarre sentence, which she's talking about how when my dad died, they lived out in Tacopa in this very small town. And she felt more in community there than she ever had living in this big city where she was a stranger to her neighbor. So like the meaning is pretty clear, but the like prosody of it is bizarre. Like I often wondered where I'd have been if I was in a city. It's like almost Borgesian, like you're in a city, but you'd often wonder where you would have been in a city and a stranger to your neighbors, but they're your neighbors. They're not strangers, but of course we all know that they are. So, and then the ending in Las Vegas is perfect because the book is like a whole vortex that like, one of its theories of physics is that Las Vegas is like a vortex that always drags you back.
Yeah, that's very true. In a number of different ways for all kinds of people. It's funny.
I've read about the Mojave like so many times and so many different, like it's a almost universal observation that there's people feel compelled, tugged, like grabbed, deeply drawn on a level that they don't understand, but they have to obey.
And that's what all the reviewers over the years have said about you, knowing it so well that you're able to convey. It's like you have this voice, like Lana Del Rey has the LA sound, you know, it's this LA kind of vibe. And you have the same with regard to Vegas and all of the places that you talk about in your book. But when you read the epigraph, it sounded like poetry. When I read it myself, it didn't sound like poetry. Now I understand the difference. So, yeah. Well, that's the other thing is that, first of all, you can talk about your book a little bit. So it begins very easily for the reader to immerse him or herself in it because you have this postnatal depression scale. And why don't you tell us why you chose to bring us in that way? And, you know, and like I said, it's kind of leads us through the book.
Yeah, it's like, and actually it's like a discursive imaginary version of that diagnostic, because the actual diagnostic is like it's not true false, it's multiple choice. And the options are, and this is, you know, to like evaluate a woman's psyche after she's given birth, the options are, you know, I've been able to laugh and see the funny side of things. It's like A, as much as I ever did, B, not quite as much now, C, not so much now, D, not at all. So like what the diagnostic test, which is a real test, is like medicine's response to the profound transformation of like birth, of giving birth, and what it might do to a psyche, to a person's like sense of herself and what she might do next, right? So 21st century for-profit medicine boils all of that down into A, as much as I ever did, not quite as much now, not so much now, not at all. So it's a paradigm where you, the best you could ever be is as much as I ever did. There's no like more than ever. The answer is not like more than ever. Since my baby is born, I've been laughing and able to see the funny side of things more than ever. Like, and the life is so much funnier, or I have looked forward with enjoyment to things. Absolutely. Like, I now think in the multiple lifespans, like I can look into the future and I can look into the past. And I realized that the material of my grandmother is inside me and literally like in my bones and my genes, and what happened to her happened to me. And it's just like totally an inadequate diagnostic for this like profound mystical experience that she's actually having. So then she creates this one that is like accidentally really honest. And then you're right, that sets like the whole thing in motion. So it's like, what if this thing could work? This inadequate diagnostic. I'm sitting there in real life with my newborn baby filling this thing out, thinking like, how would I design this tool, and how would I describe what's happening to me inside?
I like the way your husband or whoever's husband it is finds it amusing that I don't, you know, the same thing you were saying is as much as I ever did, that he goes, that's not quite fair, is it? Or that really doesn't belong in there. I can't answer that about anything that's ever happened in my life.
As much as I ever did. Yeah, why should that be the goal? Like, and this obsession with going back, like returning, like, of course, it's most visible in like the idea of getting your body back, that you would go to a pre-transformation state. Like you walk through this tremendous threshold. You were one body and now you're two beings walking around, and this little being is also very much itself. I mean, it's so bonkers. And then our culture encourages women to retreat from that and be like, I'm gonna go back. And what that will look like is exercising and making myself smaller and pretending all of that never happened, or go back to work, like we're really celebrating about, you know, that you can like continue to consume or be productive when, like, why should you? You know, maybe you're just gonna be at home having visions all day.
Well, it's like in the morning, you know, I was thinking about it because I got up and I was brushing my teeth and I thought, am I enjoying this as much as I ever did? But I do it every morning and I don't know. Maybe one day I do like it better, but it's irrelevant, first of all. And second of all, that's why I said at the beginning, what did I say? Oh, we admit things to ourselves, but not to our person. Okay. You tell me what you think that means, and I'll tell you what I think that means.
Well, I hardly remember.
You should remember. You wrote it.
She's saying, I think, something like, you know, using that phrase, her person, as in her partner or her lover or spouse or whatever. But you're like sensing it's like, you know, shadow meaning of that we can lie to ourselves and also conduct ourselves as though, you know, the opposite were true. You know, the easiest person to lie to is yourself.
Right? Yeah. And as the reader, I have the right to look at it differently than you wrote it. So the way I'm looking at it is like, yeah, is ourselves our person? Are they two different things? And yeah, you just said, yeah, they are. I mean, it's impossible to determine. It's like string theory or something like that. It's impossible to determine whether you're lying to yourself or not, unless you were able to stand outside, which of course I have an observer in my head 24/7, but yeah, unless you could stand outside and say, you know, what is this? Or, and I've asked this for the last 10 or 15, 20 interviews, because a lot of them have been about scientists who've studied human consciousness or Nobel Prize laureates in physics. I say, why is one not a prime number? Because a prime number is divisible by one and itself. So one is one, but it's also itself. I mean, you're Claire, but that's just your name. That's not what you are. So they all get mad at me, especially the ones who write about consciousness, because it screws up their whole theory. But the physicist was good. He just said, because it wouldn't be convenient. So that's me just going off, sorry.
No, that's really, really interesting. Yeah, I think the novel is kind of a response to that conundrum that you're describing of being a self and being multiple. And maybe that's why we still have novels in this era of TV and phones and pocket casinos, you know, because the novel is the psyche as art, like the inside part comes out and with language.
And plus, on top of that, the book's about you. I mean, it is your name, it is your father, it is your mother. So you have to layer that on top of it. And then the reader has to decide, when are we going somewhere else? And who are we talking about now? Because it's always going to be you.
Yeah, I think that's probably true of every character, but it's one of our little like suspensions of disbelief that we do in a maybe a more straightforward, realistic, like less postmodern, up its own asshole type of book, as Vonnegut would say, you know. But just like Claire is as much of an invention as the old guys who are living up in like the shack in Northern Nevada guy that I write about, or the prospectors in 1849, you know, like they're all from in me and built with my language. And those are the only tools I have actually, you know? So I don't think one is like more artful. I think it's all just the same. This is just like one strategy of creating like an aliveness, like a sense of this person's real. But I kind of do that with every character I write anyway. I just use different strategies to it. I don't feel like you said earlier that you thought some writer was like trapped by it, but I don't feel like it's that ideological. I just think it's like this story should be told in this shape using these tools or this palette. And then this one, I'm going to do this one again. Like I could write a straight up psychological realism, you know, regular vanilla missionary style novel tomorrow, probably. I mean, not tomorrow, but I don't feel like I've planted a flag in the moon or anything, you know?
Yeah, but when you're talking about your father being interviewed by Larry King or something like that, that's what happened. That's really what happened. And then if I'm reading the letters as a reader, I got to think, hey, I wonder if these are the letters. Are they the letters? Are they the letters modified?
Yeah, they're basically like modified beyond the point of telling who is, if it's her or me, which is like the point of it. Yeah. Well,
that's mm-hmm. part of the fun of all of it. I mean, mm-hmm. right? It's.
Yeah. Yeah, it's probably in a way just sort of a pretty standard, like postmodern deconstructed gesture. Like, this is what stories are. Like, we're magpieing them, we're making them together, but this shows like all the seams and all the stitching. And it's like, this one is from this place, this one's from Larry King, you know? And I think that that is just kind of an exciting mode to work in, or for me.
Hey, when you say Jesus pizza, is that an expression? Like, holy Jesus, is it? I never heard of it.
Yeah, in my social circle, it is. You would say, Jesus pizza, it's cold outside or something. You know?
I know. I looked it up in the Urban Dictionary, and one of them is kind of semi-obscene, so I won't say that one. But when I looked it up, there was also right underneath it a story about some guy who broke into Pizza Hut saying he was Jesus Christ. And I thought, oh, well, she could have just stuck that in there. It would have been fine. Which is why I like the one, well, it's almost a full page, when you list all the different bars in Las Vegas. That was really good too. You remember that?
Not in Reno? I can only think of a Reno
line. Okay. Oh, no, I guess it was Reno. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, because she doesn't get off out of the airport in Vegas. Well, later she does, but yeah, she really does not want to go to Vegas. So yeah, right. She's having a long, long romp around Reno for like half of the book. I kind of wanted to try to write one of those books that all takes place in like a night or something. It didn't end up quite doing it. And in fact, probably did something very opposite, but it's interesting to have, you know, a little experiment to push against.
Yeah, temporally it's hard. One of the reviews even said that, you know, you're jumping around, but you're not jumping around at all, but it is hard temporally, but so it's hard in life too. I mean, I was 18 yesterday.
I know, right? It's like, sometimes it's like, first of all, I totally agree. Some of them are so narrative. It just begins at the beginning and ends at the end. And they're pretty like expected, like Aristotelian shapes, but then there's like the shape of the mind. Yeah. Like mind time is allowed as well. And that's some of the effort. Yeah.
So Ivy, Rust, and Ty. I mean, once again, I'm in the same universe as you are, but I might be interpreting it all wrong. Are they kind of real? They seem really real. Like, they seem like you did hang out with them.
I know, they're wonderful, aren't they? They're very real. Of course they are. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and does he have really good hair or not?
The best hair, absolutely the best hair. Yeah, absolutely.
That's so funny. What about the flood? Did the flood really happen?
Yeah, according to my mom's letters that I base those letters on, she wrote about a huge flood. And Las Vegas floods a lot. Like, it's a fiasco of a city made by the mob, you know, so it's not known for its like robust and well-planned infrastructure, but that's been true since, you know, you paved the meadows.
I ran my one and only marathon. I ran in Las Vegas, and it was horrible because I thought I was going to be running down the strip and looking at all the stuff and being distracted. And what they did was they bust us out 26 miles. And then we had a run. It was the windiest, coldest day in the history of Las Vegas. There was glass all over the road. They ran out of water. And you were running, no matter which way you were going, you were running against the wind. It was impossible not to be running against the wind. Mm-hmm. My brother made me do it. And it was really irritating. And so I never ran a marathon again after that. It's pathetic. And then I wrote to them and told them how much it sucked. And so they said they would waive the entry fee for me next year.
That's the Vegas way. Yeah. A legendary hospitality.
That's the same brother that also took his snake, Fred, and put him in his freezer for 10 years. Hmm. And then one day just decided, okay, I'm going to bury him now. So he kept him there for 10 years. And then he goes, okay, now's the time to take him out and bury him.
Well, grief has its own clock, you know?
So did your mom put a rattlesnake in the freezer?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had a rattlesnake in our freezer for about 10 years. Yeah, my mom found it. It was dead, and she wanted to taxidermy it for this little museum she ran. It's still there. It's called the Shoshone Museum in Shoshone, California. So she put it in the freezer. It was like coiled up and in a Ziploc bag. And It looked really real. You couldn't, it wasn't squished or anything. That's why she wanted to taxidermy it. And then you would forget that it was there until somebody would like knew, like a friend is over and you're like, want some popsicles? Yeah, I'll get some for us. And then they're like, ah, you know, huge snake in the freezer. And you'd be like, oh yeah, I forgot. I'm sorry. There's a snake in the freezer. Look out. But I don't know what happened to it. I don't think it ever made its way into the museum.
Yeah, my brother's was much more metaphysical. Just the idea that one day, you know, it's like this, it's like the postnatal quiz is like, mm-hmm. when did you feel like it was really necessary to take your snake out of the freezer and bury him? You know, what day and why?
It's like, get ready on your own time, you know? Yeah. I'm sure there's that dimension with our snake as well.
Are you impulsive?
Impulsive?
Yeah.
No. I'm a bit of an overthinker, actually. I'm kind of a recovering perfectionist, so I would like to be more impulsive, as in like spontaneous and moving by intuition. Why do you ask?
Because I was just thinking of my brother and the snake. He overthinks too. Mm-hmm. And both my brothers do, you know, and they end up making good decisions. And I'm really horribly impulsive. Like, I might be thinking about something that I just, well, like, one of my many divorces, well, my two divorces, they just happened because the first one, I just picked up the phone. That's it. It's like when you're driving and you think you can just turn the wheel this way and that'll end everything.
Yeah.
It's like that. It's like, that's how my mind works. And sometimes it works out and sometimes it's like the worst thing ever. Once again, this leads nowhere. This is the way my interviews go. It's like, okay, now what? What can you possibly say? Oh, okay. Oregon Trail. Oregon Trail is like a big part of the book. In fact, it's kind of like pivotal in a way. So
yeah, it's one of the major myths going through it. Yeah.
Well, so did you play Oregon Trail when you were a kid?
Yeah, definitely. I played Oregon Trail on the computers at school all through elementary school in Nevada.
Was it an Apple IIc or a Macintosh?
I can't really be sure. Yeah, it was like a number, you know, it was years and years. We did it so much and I was like really good at it.
But it was a horrible game, which is where your book goes.
Horrible. What's horrible about it?
Because if you didn't do it the right way, all these poor little kids and people died. They died trying to get to some place that was their dream.
Yeah. Yeah, it was horrible, but because they died, when they really died, they died because they were greedy. You know, like in Death Valley, like the party that gave it its famous name, you know, it's like they all almost died, including like women and children. And they swore, like in their journals, they said, like, I can't believe I did this just for greed, for money, for gold, freaking gold. I could walk by a boulder of gold, like a nugget as big as me, and I wouldn't even look at it for because I want water, right? Because they're dying of thirst. And but then they get rescued and they get out and they go back looking for gold. You know, they don't stay changed, but they do recognize like their deep profound folly in the moment. So that's a fascinating like elasticity of the mind to me about Oregon Trail as a myth, like pioneer fetishism and how it informs our big mistakes in the West today.
It's interesting how you list the various incarnations of the Oregon Trail, but you say starring, but you don't say.
Yeah. Yeah, I was kind of thinking like I just wanted to stop where she would stop reading, you know, because we read the internet in such a fragmented way. And what she really wants to know is like the name of the author who makes up that theory, which is in a way my way of like giving her credit because I'm like using it and writing about it so much and writing these characters who really believe in, or they're intrigued by the idea of themselves as like Oregon Trail generation, like new pioneers of a new way of being. And they're kind of like testing it out to varying degrees of success. And also just to illustrate how recursive that is as a myth, you know, that it keeps popping up, like keeps being told in every different, as the forms develop from the journals to books and then TV shows and video games. It just like it keeps mutating. Like we really need that story as a culture in the American West. It props up so many of like the other myths about Western exceptionalism and manifest destiny and like how the land, like we have a benevolent presence on the land, which is debatable.
Very much so. The way you started describing that at first reminded me of when you or whoever you are were talking about micro generations. Because my son, the one I played Oregon Trail with, which could define a micro generation, was born in 1980. And that was exactly the right time for Oregon Trail when he was 5 years old. Mm-hmm. And 80 or 81 is the cutoff for millennials, right?
Yeah. We'd have to read Anna Garvey's think piece that she wrote about this, but I think you're right about that.
Yeah, I did read it before when I was whatever I am doing, researching or whatever. And yeah, so that micro generations, I've never really thought about it till I read the book. And then I started looking into it and I realized, yeah, it's some of you are stuck in a place that isn't this or isn't that. And, mm-hmm. and you don't have a letter.
Yeah. And then I like how one of the other characters is like, all of this is a scam. Generations were invented by advertising executives. You know, there's really not noticeable differences culturally between these age groups. It's a dumb, like divisive way of thinking about our community. But we do think that way a lot. And then we're wondering like, what if I don't want to be either of these? And I think they kind of carve out their own little micro generation, but also is about the anxiety of technology, you know, because they kind of come of age with the internet and they're wondering like, did that experience fundamentally like isolate us from the other people who are a little bit older and a little bit younger than us?
If you're outside the generation, it's a lot easier to see what's happening. Here's a good example. So my bookstore has gotten really full, so I don't have any room for manga or graphic novels. So I'm opening a new store right across the street, smaller, and all it is manga. Cool. And I just put like one little tiny little lozenge of a Japanese kid with red eyes with the right kind of hair. And all these people applied for jobs immediately. And they're all so excited that they would work basically for free, like a baseball, like Tom Brady would play football even if he wasn't getting any money, that kind of thing. And they all just want to be there. And you look at this enthusiasm, it's like, you know, how Japan wanted to copy the West. It's like they want to copy Japan so badly that, you know, they want to open books from right to left. I mean, that's it pretty much. And yeah, it's astonishing. And I wasn't doing it, not that you can make any money at a bookstore anyway, but I wasn't doing it to make money. I'm doing it because it's kind of cool. And it's like, I want to see why this is the way it is, because I'm so far behind the curve.
Well, I can imagine, it's easy to imagine why you might want to escape our kind of garbagey culture, you know, sometimes, and see how people from other places live. You could see that in like another subset with this, like, you know, white affluent American obsession with Buddhism or mindfulness or yoga, or, you know, yearning for something beyond one's culture, feeling it to be not enough for them, you know?
Well, it's like your book. Can you imagine it being like 4 or 5 squares on each page showing you walking through and your friends hanging around and sitting at a booth and stuff like that? I mean, it's just like now with the graphic novels, even at school, like stuff like The Old Man and the Sea, and you think about that, it would be so cool to watch the boat, him in the boat and the rope going through his hands and bleeding and the marlin tied to the side of the boat and the shark coming. The pictures of it are really good. I mean, it makes you feel like it would be just as meaningful.
Of course.
You should you should write a graphic novel.
Okay.
You're right on the edge of, yeah. You know what was the saddest line in the book? Mm-hmm. When you let yourself in the house to shower and smell her things. I thought.
Yeah, that's the end of a chapter called The Scene at the Arb, which is mostly a campus satire. And then it has that really sincere turn at the end, you know, because it's like, she may not be being punished and she's not miserable, but she does have consequences. You know, she does have like the full range of human emotions. So it's going to be very hard to take time away from your infant baby. You know, it's not without like consequence, but it's also not, it is, I guess, you know, the therapist would say it's within the window of tolerance, you know, but just barely, like in weather, you know, just barely bearable.
Yeah, I'm interviewing some woman who wrote supposedly the new biography of Sylvia Plath. You know, I hate Ted Hughes. He's like the guy I hate more than anyone in the world. You know, to have one wife stick her head in the oven is maybe coincidence, but to have two of them, I mean, seriously. But Sylvia at least tapes up the door and leaves her kids inside and leaves food and all that. But Asiya, whatever her name is, she kills her kid with her, Ted Hughes' kid. So it's like, I don't know what made me think of that, except what you were saying about there's consequences. There's behavior that's just inside, and then there's behavior that's just outside.
You take care. We love, I mean, we, in a way, you know, that's a vagina dentata story. Like, that's the myth of the feminine evil story. Like, we're really drawn to the, like, you know, the matricidal, like, impulse. It's like a primal fear, because this person, you needed her to keep you alive. You know, one of the earliest things you could ever know is that she could not do that. She could stop. Like, so maybe that has something to do with our fear of female freedom or something, you know. But in this case, in this book, that isn't going to happen at all. That's pretty clear in the beginning of the story. You know, she says, I don't want to hurt the baby and I don't want to hurt myself. But those are the only people who are off limits, basically. And then the rest is like tearing away from there. So I think, I don't know. I think it's like we kind of like go to that, like it's like a collective anxiety we have. And not to say that that doesn't happen, but when it does happen, we're so like the Andrea Yates phenomenon, you know, like we're so drawn to it and we think, and that's what we associate when we think about like postpartum depression, which, as I say, is medicine's word for what's happening, not my word. But then it's like, are you going to hurt your child? And there's this whole other realm of experience that, like, if you instead said, like, what do you need or something, then you could open up. But yeah, that image of the dual gesture of protecting the children and hurting the self. But, you know, that was, I think she was mistaken about that division. That I don't think that her children were unharmed by her decision, of course. Yeah. That's like the last line of Weather is like, the core delusion is that I am here and you are there. You know, like she is her children.
Yeah, and Sylvia's son committed suicide in Alaska. Hugh. So the readings, once she goes to the readings and she's got to get high and she wants to be at a 4.5 or whatever, it's you. And I kind of want to ask, you know, because it's reading, so you do that all the time. So I kind of ask you, you know, did you ever say that? Did you ever say no poem ever saved the Jew from the oven?
Oh God, yeah. I've done every stupid thing you could do at a reading because they make me very nervous and people make bad choices when they're scared or stressed, as Moana says, you know? I mean, no, that's Frozen, I think. Yeah.
Anyway, no, it's not Frozen. That's just, yeah. No, Frozen is Elsa.
Listen, I know Frozen from Frozen, and that is Frozen. It's the trolls when Kristoff takes her to meet his troll family, and that's her song. People make bad choices when they're sad or scared or stressed. Or maybe it's mad or scared or stressed, but that's the lyric, and that's the film.
All right, you got me. Well, I just assumed it was like some.
Anyway, she is heroically unprepared for every public speaking event and every honor. It's really hard for her to accept that those moments. So she like lashes out in spectacular ways. That all of that stuff is like wish fulfillment for me. You know, I would love to just lay on the floor and listen to pet sounds every time I was supposed to like give a speech or a workshop or something, you know.
Did you ever listen to the Beta Band? You should listen to them. There's a, because it has a song about pet sounds. But, oh yeah, so that no poem ever saved the Jew from the oven. So Camus says something like, in a world of victims and executioners, it's the job of thinking people to not be on the side of the executioners. And then I thought, well, if you're thinking and you're not on the side of the executioners, you're going to get executed. I mean, that's what's going to happen. And I don't know why that makes me think of your book, but it does. I mean, if you decide to be the good person and you're thinking about being the good person, that doesn't, just like the poem doesn't save the Jew, you thinking that you're going to be good doesn't necessarily mean that you're not going to be sacrificed in some way. You don't have to answer. It's another one. Do you have fobs on your keys?
I'm a member of the Price Club at my grocery store. I've got a fob for that, the library fob.
Yeah. I hate fobs. It's horrible that they make you do that. It ruins your keys, and then for guys, you put them in your pockets and the fobs are sticking into your thigh or something. How many do you have?
I think just those two, but if you want, I can check to be just really diligent about it. But you know what I find objectionable about fobs and the whole, like, it's probably the gentlest data mining that we experience, you know, like, can I have your number or scan your card for your deal or whatever? But it's like, just give me the deal. Just give a fair price, obviously. And also like the theater, as if they don't really know where we are already, you know, like, I know that you are like, my phone is in my pocket and you know what I'm buying and you can see it in my bank. And like, it's this fake, like, may I have permission with your fob? And be like, why? Sure, I consent and I'll give you my fob. It's like, you wish you had a fob to keep all of that information, you know, secret. Oh no, I don't think so. I won't be using my fob today. Oh, that's okay. We'll use the store's fob, you know? And that's another thing. It's like, just use it every time then.
I avoid the, I mean, if I had a fob, but what I did with my health club fob was I Xeroxed the fob and then I cut it into a little piece of paper. And then I stuck it to the window of the health club in a place where no one could see it. So then I don't have to carry it with me. So I just take it off of there, stick it, put it back. And no one cleans up paper anymore anyway. Like my father said, if you want to clean up something, clean it up yourself because no one else is going to do it. So the piece of paper is just there and I can use it as my fob. I'm going to do it everywhere.
I think that's genius. I think that's genius. I don't know why you don't just carry the paper with you, but I guess that's the whole point, because you resent the task, the assignment. Take this with you, bring it back, right?
Hey, why am I carrying something for you and I don't want to carry it and then I'll lose it and, you know, it's stupid.
Don't give me another thing to do. Yeah, I know. Well, our attention is being like, you know, cent by cent, second by second, just harvested, like our well-being and our peace. So I'm not surprised you feel irritated.
Did you know Elon Musk is a juggalo?
I know. Is that true?
I read it. I don't know if it's true. When I was looking up juggalos, and Clown Posse said had a list of people who are juggalos, and he was one of them.
He could learn a lot from time with the juggalos. I would encourage that cross-cultural exchange if he went to, like, you know, under one of the bridges in the Truckee River and just hung out and listened, did a little listening tour. That would be nice.
I didn't really want you guys to give up that dessert cart. I was like really hungry and it seemed like you should have kept it and eaten at least some of the
trash bag full of popcorn in exchange.
So. Yeah, but it was stale and I don't know where it came from.
That's not a movie theater. They just throw it out there for wasteful reasons.
I was at the gas station. I had bought a, I didn't feel like waiting for them to make me a sandwich. So I bought this ham and cheese sandwich. And then I went out and I, just like I always do, I put it on the side of the gas pump so it wouldn't fall. And then when I put the handle back, it fell. And then it fell like upside down, of course. And, but it was by the gas pump. And I picked it up and put it back together again. And I thought, you know, this is fine. 5 second rule, whatever. And I ate it. And in the middle, there was this like piece of grit. And then I thought, you know, maybe there's heavy metal like cadmium or something like that.
Yeah, I do not follow the 5 second rule.
No one does anymore.
Context for no. You can't live in a, I don't follow the 5,000 year rule at a gas station. You know, I'm not going to be eating at the gas stations.
Sorry. I mean, I don't see what the big deal is. What the hell could happen to you? Everyone makes a big deal out of things. You're covered with dirt all day long. It's like living in China. I mean, you're breathing in all this crap. So it's ham and cheese and there's a little bit of mustard on them. If it wasn't for the mustard, it probably wouldn't pick up anything. It's the mustard that does it, I think, personally.
You're right, but I might be blowing it out of proportion.
Well, no, I think pretty much everyone would agree with you, but it's just that I don't really worry about stuff like that. Nothing bad has ever happened to me, really. I've never broken a bone in my body. Have you?
No, you're right that like as far as toxins at the gas station, the sandwich is the least of your worries. You know? Yeah. Yeah. It's like, if only. Again, it's the fob thinking, right? Hopelessly naive.
I know that did enter my mind when I was telling my story, but I don't know why. So are you always gonna be Claire? You've been Claire before because I just listened to our last interview.
Mm-hmm.
And that was eight years ago. So you were Claire then, now you're Claire still.
Yeah. One of the first stories I ever wrote that was good and is the first story in Battleborn is in this kind of mode too, this like Claire mm-hmm. mode. And it's also sort of surreal. It combines those two elements. No, to answer your question, if I'm going to be always, like I said, like I didn't put the flag in the moon, like, no, I'll just tell the next story in the way that the next story needs to be told, which I don't know what that will be until it's done. And even then it's none of my business really, as far as I'm concerned, you know, but I'm not like ideological like that. You know, I don't feel like it's my job to save some sort of, I don't know. I was like trained as a writer in the aftermath of those like bickering in the 80s about experimental fiction. And it just seemed so inane, like their real, you know, 20th century concerns. I think that it's interesting that people, a lot of writers find this mode to be one of the most compelling ways to describe what it's like to be here now. I think that's worth like getting curious about. And I'm like interested in those conversations, but it's not like when I write a book, I'm not saying this is how the book, every book is should ever be written or anything, you know?
Like my kids, they ask me, they go, what was it like in the 19s? They don't even say 1900s. They say in the 19s and talk about feeling old, be like, when I was born, talking about the 18s, and I did. There were people from the 18s around when I was born. It's like the last Confederate widow kind of deal.
Yes. Yeah, time it gets very stretchy for all of us at certain thresholds in life, I think. And for me, motherhood has been one. Many have described a similar phenomenon during the pandemic of just feeling like things are a lot less reliable than they used to be, that they're like transformed and they don't really know how. And they're just like sitting in this not knowing for a couple years, you know?
Yeah, especially if you're like at 11 o'clock, like I am, I don't have time to be fucked over. You know, it's 11 o'clock. I only have an hour left.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Mm-hmm. Like,
mm-hmm.
Everyone gets so sick of me talking about that I'm going to die soon. You know, I'll be 70 in May. It's like, what the hell? What the hell? The hell, it's ridiculous. It's absurd.
You've been around the sun nearly 70 times. That's incredible. Yeah, you are. Your time in your body is going to be up soon. But of course, we don't want. Do you think that since the pandemic has started, people have gotten more comfortable or more aware of comfort is a lot to ask in this day and age? More aware of just
mortality?
Yes. One of my friends said, things change when death enters the room. And for a lot of people, the pandemic was maybe the first time that death had entered the room. Those of us who live in the Mojave Desert, where our government's dropping nuclear bombs, we've been in that room, you know, but it reminded me a lot of that, watching people's like consciousness about death and what to do with your time that you have here, just kind of like explode open.
It's like that quote, I can't remember who said it, that nothing focuses the mind more sharply than the fear of immediate impending death, you know?
Yeah, right. It's very clarifying. I mean, that's what I think brings most people out to this desert where I live, is that like they want to come to a place that there's not a lot of water and it gets very scary. And almost, I think everyone has this fear response at first. And then if you can like push through that, things get very, very interesting. There's like a clarity and a simplicity, and it's good for you to realize that you don't have forever in this form, at least.
Remember the interview you did where someone comes out to visit you, I forgot who it is, and you say, someone says something about your child, and you go, look at me. My father was with Charles Manson, and then my mother was crazy. Look at me, I'm fine. Right? Do you remember that?
Yeah, I didn't say that my mother was crazy, but she asked, you know, what if my daughter read my book? And I was saying, well, I read my dad's book, and I'm fine. I don't really think the truth can hurt you, you know? I'm not worried about
that. Did you say you were fine, like you really were fine? I thought you were saying fine sarcastically.
Well, both, I think, you know, am I like a paradigm of whatever, like, I guess it's like, what is fine? I'm fine with myself. Absolutely. Like totally genuinely very fine. And wouldn't be able to write a book like this if I weren't really fine, which is the weird secret of it. You know, like you can not. I don't think I can make good art from a really bad place. And I don't think that it would come out well if it weren't part of a larger, more interesting, like personal process that I'm going through.
I don't think Franz Kafka would agree with you, but that's Franz Kafka. Do you have any pets?
No, I do have a lot of plants.
Yeah, I know, because if you had pets, Diffenbachia is poisonous to them. Are we done?
I guess so.
Okay. Unless you want to say what your book is about. You want to say what your book is about?
I can't. I have no idea what it is about, really. It's a mystery to me. It's none of my business anyway.
I like the way you said that. It's the second time you said that. That's nice. Well,
I don't know why. You don't have to know to do it, you know? I think like this is a posthumous, this is like an autopsy mode. Like, what is it about? I don't know. I'm comfortable. I just don't want to say it. It ruins some of the magic for me. I want to be protective of not like over articulating it, I guess.
Would you like talking it like with me about it? Or is it like you just want to sell books by talking to me so that other people listen?
I mean, can it be both, Sam? Why be binary about this?
Well, I mean, I don't know why anyone would talk to me in the first place, but apparently.
You're a legendary bookseller.
All right. In another 8 years, because I missed your novel. I don't know how I missed it. I mean, I don't know why I didn't set up an interview with you. You should have called me. Remember.
Another 8 years or so. That sounds about right.
Oh, I'm supposed to tell you. Oh, that's right. Terry Gross question. What are you working on now?
No, you're not. You're Terry. Nothing. I'm not really working on anything. I'm just like resting.
Okay. and go back to that.
Thanks.
You look comfortable.
Yeah, I am really comfortable.
Thank you. Yeah. You know, actually, yeah, you seem really comfortable, like a comfortable person, which is what you were saying about yourself. You know, you seem regular.
Well, I've been alone with myself for a long time now. So, you know, we've gotten like all comfortable together.
Okay.
Thank you for doing this, for having me on.
Yeah, thanks for talking to me. It's always fun talking to you. Although I can't really remember the first time, but it seemed this was fun anyway.
Yeah, it's nice to do it on this side of the portal.
Likewise. Okay. Talk to you soon.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.